Researchers at the Large Hadron Collider have detected one of the rarest particle decays seen in nature. The finding deals a significant blow to the theory of physics known as supersymmetry, and many researchers had hoped that the LHC would have confirmed this by now. Supersymmetry has gained popularity as a way to explain some of the inconsistencies in the traditional theory of subatomic physics known as standard model. Now, what does that all mean? Well, we're going to talk about that and also the particle at the end of the universe. Next up, Sean Carroll joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. You know, we've talked a lot on this program about the Higgs boson, the God particle. But what does it mean? Truly, what does it mean? Well, let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Sean Carroll, PhD, theoretical physicist at California's Institute of Technology, noted author as well, also wrote the book From Eternity to Here. After receiving his doctorate from Harvard University, he pursued research on particle physics, cosmology, gravitation. He's one of the founders of the group blog Cosmic Variance, and here is Sean Carroll on Coast to Coast back again. Sean, how are you?
Good. How are you doing, George?
Good. All is well. All is well indeed. Lots of exciting things going on in the world of physics, huh?
Yeah, it's a great time to be thinking about, you know, the fundamental constituents of the universe. We've had a very good year here.
We did. A home run indeed. Look, was the Large Hadron Collider worth the billions of dollars it cost to build?
Well, obviously, you're asking me. I'm going to say, yes, it absolutely was. It does cost a lot of money. There's no question that we should admit that. But it's over the course of many, many years, and it's from many, many countries that are contributing to it. And what we get for it is, in some sense, priceless. You know, a piece of knowledge about how the world works that would otherwise there simply be no way to get. It's not like if you spend half as much money, you get half a Higgs boson. If you spend half as much money, you wouldn't discover anything new at all.
What is truly the Higgs boson? You know, we've heard about this God particle for several years now. I don't think any one of us, outside of you, can explain what it means.
You know, I'm quick to admit that it is hard to explain it because, not because it's hard to understand, but because it requires two steps. There's what really matters to us is not the Higgs boson, but something called the Higgs field that fills space. You probably have heard this story that when you just see light from a light bulb, light is an electromagnetic wave, right? So you have electric fields and magnetic fields, and they're vibrating, and those vibrations are traveling from the light bulb to your eyeballs. But you probably also heard that we can think about that light as particles, as photons of light. So the Higgs is exactly the same way. There's a field filling space called the Higgs field. And the bosons that we detect, these particles, are just the little vibrations in that field. And all of that is a warm-up of saying that what we care about is the Higgs field that fills space much more than the Higgs boson, which is just evidence that the field is really there.
How did scientists even know to start looking for all of this?
Well, that's a great question, because this is a real triumph of how we do physics. It was back in the 1960s. In 1963 and 1964, physicists were stuck with this problem of understanding the nuclear forces, what holds protons and neutrons together in the nucleus of an atom. And there are two nuclear forces, the strong and the weak. And in the early 60s, we didn't really know anything about them. We had a lot of data. Our understanding was very, very poor. So a whole bunch of ideas were flying around. And one idea was, well, maybe it's a lot like electricity and magnetism, but somehow electrical fields and magnetic fields can stretch across the room, and these nuclear force fields are really short range. They don't stretch outside the nucleus. If you have two protons and they're far away, they'll be pushed apart because they're both positively charged, and same charged particles repel each other. But if they get very, very close, then that strong nuclear force kicks in and pulls them together. So the physicists were like, well, how can we make a version of this electromagnetic force that we understand so well, but one that is short range? And the answer that they came up with just by thinking about it hard is, if there was some field filling the universe that as we travel through it, you know, as we walk through the room or if we travel through interstellar space, if this field is all around us interacting with all of our particles, it can cut off the nuclear force. It can make it perfectly effective over short ranges, but die off so you don't notice it over long ranges. And it was an audacious idea. I mean, you know, sure, maybe that's it. Maybe there's lots of other things. But that idea seemed to fit together really well. And the prediction that that idea made was, well, this field is going to have vibrations in it, and those vibrations are going to show up as a new particle of nature. And now, 45 years later or more, we've actually found the thing. We knew what we were looking for. We've looked for it for decades, and it's finally showed up. And some of these physicists were there. These, you know, they're 80 years old now. They were in the room, and you know, it's a very emotional moment when the discovery was announced this July. They broke down a little bit because it's sometimes hard to believe an idea you had half a lifetime ago. People spent $1 billion chasing, and now there it is.
The fact that it exists, what does that mean?
Well, it means that we understand how the particles that make us up work. That's, you know, it's an audacious way to put it, but that's how it is. You know, we had this theory for a long time of all the, so in 1960s, we didn't understand the strong and weak nuclear forces. And then by 10 years later, we had an excellent theory of both the strong force and the weak force. And the one missing ingredient that we hadn't detected was this Higgs boson, which would tell us that the Higgs field was really there. If you take our understanding of particle physics and you imagine there was no such thing as the Higgs field, then particles like electrons that make up, you know, the outer part of your atoms, and electrons do everything for us, right? Everything electronic is electrons moving around. Atoms are electrons surrounding the nuclei. All of chemistry is electrons talking to each other. And if it weren't for the Higgs, these electrons would be massless. Would they be like photons? They'd be moving at the speed of light. They wouldn't stick together in atoms. There wouldn't be any chemistry. There wouldn't be any planets or stars. There would not be you or me. So without the Higgs field, the universe doesn't make sense to us at all. And that doesn't mean that it's there, right? We have to actually go out and find it. That's how physics works. And now we think we found it.
It sure sounds like somebody designed this pretty smartly.
Somebody's. There's a lot of people, you know, probably a total of 10,000 people in one way or the other have been involved with the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. And, you know, there's two giant experiments working on it. And both experiments have over 3,000 collaborators. So every time they get a result and they publish a paper, there's 3,000 authors on the paper. And this is something the whole community has to do. You know, particle physics has become such a big enterprise that no one country can do it, including the United States. You know, we had a big particle accelerator plan ourselves, the superconducting supercollider in Texas, and we gave up and closed it down because we couldn't afford it.
Now, have we found the Higgs boson or not? Because, you know, I know they said that they found a Higgs-like particle, but have we found the God particle?
Yeah, it depends on how picky you want to be. I'm happy to go either way. We found a particle. That's absolutely clear. It has all of the properties we would have expected the Higgs boson to have, but we did just detect it very shortly ago. So, you know, like anything new, we haven't learned everything there is to know about it yet. So we're still not 100% sure that it's precisely the original idea, or maybe it's some variation that we're not sure of yet. So that's going to be a big program for years now, is studying the properties of this new discovery we've made. And all of the physicists in the world are hoping that it's not the original Higgs boson, that it's something we haven't quite thought of yet that teaches us something new. That's how we make progress.
Did Einstein know about this, about the Higgs boson?
He did not. He passed away in the 1950s. And our understanding of elementary particle physics at the time was very, very poor. You know, it was just a mess. In fact,
right,
there's a very good story that is told by Leon Lederman. Leon Lederman is the Nobel Prize-winning experimental particle physicist who actually coined the term God particle. He's still around today, but when he was young, when he was a graduate student, it was in the 1950s. And he was working at Columbia in New York City, and he and his friend went down to Princeton to visit Einstein. And it wasn't like, you know, an official set-up seminar or anything like that. They basically stalked him. They waited outside his office at the Institute for Advanced Study to bump into him, quote-unquote, accidentally. And they finally did, and they were talking to him, and he was very polite to them. And, you know, he said, explain to me what you're doing. And they said, oh, we're doing these experiments to discover new particles. And Einstein nodded and patiently, and then he said, that is not interesting. Bye, boys. And then he walked away. So this is not Einstein's cup of tea, the whole particle physics game.
Had he been around now, what would he be doing?
That's a great question. You know, I don't want to speak for Einstein. In his early days, he was a very mainstream thinker in the sense that he was working on the questions that everyone was interested in. He was right there in the center of the action, and he was a little bit smarter than everybody else, so he got there first with relativity and things like that. And he kept up, you know, his involvement in mainstream science his whole life, but he was so successful as a youngster in sort of single-handedly revolutionizing the field that he never felt the need to work on the things that everyone else thought was interesting after that time. So he went his own way, and he tried to construct this unified theory of all the forces of nature. And the one of the reasons why he didn't succeed is we didn't know what all the forces of nature were at that time. So it might be that if he were alive today, he would be working on one of the attempts that we have to unify the forces, like superstring theory, for example. I mean, he was a brilliant theoretical physicist. He was not an experimenter. He didn't have a lab. He didn't tinker around. Like me and like many others, he sat in his office with a pencil and paper and wrote down equations and tried to figure out how things could possibly make sense. So I suspect he'd be doing quantum field theory, superstring theory, something like that. But, you know, he was Einstein, so he was very smart. He might have surprised us all.
Maybe so. Maybe so. With the knowledge of the Higgs boson, what does that do to an individual in their day-to-day life, Sean?
Nothing at all, unless they want to know how the world works. The whole quest for the Higgs boson is not fundamentally about technology or our everyday lives. You know, 100 years ago, there was no difference between doing fundamental physics and doing applied physics. They were discovering things like electromagnetism and quantum mechanics and lasers and semiconductors and all these wonderful things. But we've reached the point now where, again, we understand basic physics well enough to do all the technology that we want to do. And this new stuff we're discovering, the Higgs boson, or if we discover the dark matter and so forth, we do not anticipate any technological applications at all. We could be surprised, of course. You know, we've got to be open-minded. We're not very good at predicting the future, but that's not why we do it. We do it because we really want to understand the guts of our universe. And, of course, along the way, in order to do that, we have to build something like the Large Hadron Collider, the largest machine ever built. And in doing that, we have enormous technological obstacles to overcome, and we keep inventing new things that do have tremendous everyday technological applications. The most famous example by far is a little thing you might have heard of called the World Wide Web.
Oh, yeah.
This was invented at CERN, at the Particle Physics Laboratory in Geneva, where they discovered the Higgs boson, because the first people who needed the ability to share files back and forth effortlessly were particle physicists. And so they invented this thing called the web, which has turned out to be pretty useful. And, you know, likewise, many computer advances, technology advances, superconductivity and so forth, have come out of doing particle physics. So it's not that the Higgs boson gets us direct technological benefits, but the search for the Higgs boson certainly does.
Well, with Sean Carroll, of course, his new work, The Particle at the End of the Universe. What's the difference, Sean, between a theoretical physicist and just a physicist?
Well, it's a big difference in a field like particle physics, where there's almost nobody who works simultaneously as a world-class theoretical physicist and as a world-class experimental physicist. The field has become very, very specialized because there's just so much knowledge you need to do either one of those that it's very difficult to master both. So a theoretical physicist sits around and says something like, okay, you know, here's the Higgs boson data that we have. Let me try to build a model that is consistent with this data but goes beyond what we know. So maybe I can write down a new theory that explains both the Higgs boson we see and the dark matter that we haven't yet seen. Or maybe I can write down a new theory where the Higgs boson is actually a composite of two different particles, just like protons and neutrons are composites of quarks and gluons. Whereas an experimentalist isn't writing down models, is not chasing equations to make new predictions, so much as building equipment, carrying out these experiments, collecting data, analyzing the data, making these technological breakthroughs we talked about, and really making the discoveries that push the theoretical physicists in the right direction.
Sean, if we were to have a powerful microscope, so powerful that we could get down to the most minute first stage particle, whatever it might be, as you look at a human body and you see the body and you see the cell level and it gets smaller and smaller, what is that very first particle?
Yeah, wouldn't I like to know? That would be awesome.
we don't know that, huh?
We don't know that. No, certainly not.
But there's got to be the very first one down there, right?
Well, you know, I suspect that there is, but I'm too cautious to say there's got to be because we don't know the answer. And historically, human beings have had a very bad track record at saying something must be true before we've actually showed that it is the case.
Well, let me ask you this. Let me rephrase it. Uh-huh. What is the smallest known particle we know of so far?
Well, the set of particles that belong to what we call the standard model of particle physics. So that's things like electrons and neutrinos and the quarks and also the Higgs boson, the photon, the force scattering particles. All of these, as far as we can tell, have no internal structure. They are point-like particles. They are in some sense of zero size. Now, there's a little bit fuzziness there because of quantum mechanics. You know, you can't actually pin the particle down to zero size because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. But we don't know of any particles smaller than these. But at the same time, we are very, very aware that our understanding is incomplete. So it may be that these are fundamental particles, or it may be that we just haven't looked at small enough distances yet. Like you said, our microscopes aren't quite good enough yet to tell whether they're truly fundamental.
It's amazing thinking of the complexity and at the same time, the simplicity of all of this. I mean, it seems like it goes both ways, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The whole history of physics is that we study things and they're puzzling and we don't know what's going on and things get more complicated and weirder and we're scratching our heads and then suddenly a great idea comes along and we go, oh yeah, now all that makes sense. And this is exactly what was happening in the 50s and 60s, this explosion of data from accelerators. We were discovering all these new particles, and we didn't know how they fit together. There was this joke made by Willis Lamb, who was a Nobel Prize winner in the late 1950s. He said, it used to be if you discovered a new elementary particle, you won the Nobel Prize. Nowadays, they discover so many that discovering a new particle should get you a $10,000 fine. But then, in the 1960s, we invented quarks. And in fact, there's a very small number of quarks, but they fit together in many different combinations. And suddenly, all of those particles we had been discovering made sense to us. They were just different configurations of quarks. So we're hoping the same thing happens at some time in the future. We have, you know, a picture of the world with four forces, one Higgs boson, six quarks, and six leptons, and it fits all the data. It's just too messy to be the right final answer. So all of us are trying to think of a simple, compelling model that would spill out and explain all of this complexity.
Why did so many countries collaborate on the Large Hadron Collider?
It's a fascinating story, actually. It was after World War II when Europe, you know, had been decimated right and left, and a few far-reaching physicists wanted to sort of restart physics in Europe. And, you know, they thought it would be a good project to pull people together and pool the resources of all of Europe's countries, or at least Western Europe at that time. And so they founded this laboratory, which we now call CERN, the Center European Research Nuclear. This was the original acronym. It's in French. So this is outside Geneva on the border of France and Switzerland, and it's ever since the 1950s, CERN has been the center for particle physics in Europe, and the Europeans decided early on that in order to compete with the United States, They would have to pool their resources. It was not going to be, you know, England or Germany or France individually.
Hold on, Sean. Let's come back to that story in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Sean Carroll, physicist. We're talking about his work, The Particle at the End of the Universe. And we'll come back and talk more with him about this on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Sean Carroll with us. Sean, The Particle at the End of the Universe. And the book just came out, didn't it?
Today was release day, yeah.
How about that for timing, huh?
Very well done, yes.
Can paint us a picture. What does the Large Hadron Collider at CERN look like, and how does it work?
Yeah, it's a tremendous technological achievement, the largest machine ever built. It's in a tunnel underground, so you go down 330 feet. If you're standing on the surface, you know, above the collider, it would just look like a pastoral setting, a field. There'd be cows, mountains in the distance, the French Alps. And underneath, there's a tunnel that goes 17 miles around in a circle. And inside this tunnel, there are these magnets that are incredibly powerful. And they take these particles, the protons that make up, you know, people like you and me. They strip off the electrons. It's just the protons. And they're zipping around at 99.9999999% the speed of light. And they smash them together at the experimental points along the ring, which are these giant machines, much, much bigger than a human being, much bigger than a bus or, you know, the size of a cathedral, basically. And the energy from these collisions creates new particles which spread out, and they have incredibly fast and adept technological apparatus that detects the different particles, tells us what they are, and then we reconstruct what happened. And it's so much data. You know, if you actually took all the data that was created at the Large Hadron Collider and tried to save it to a hard drive, you know, within minutes, you would fill up more data than the largest database in the world. So you pick and choose. You try to look for the really interesting collisions, the really interesting interactions, and keep those. And it's been working like clockwork. There was a few hiccups when it first started going in 2008, but starting in 2009, it's been performing flawlessly.
Well, it's an amazing piece of machinery. How did somebody even conceive of it in terms of structuring it and how to build it?
Yeah, you know, it happens gradually. You know, it happens, the idea of sort of particles circling around and colliding grew up very gradually over the 20th century. We know that if you put a charged particle in a magnetic field, it will circle around. So that part we understood. And getting them to collide was a whole other thing. There's a Nobel Prize given basically just for figuring out how to stabilize the beams of particles to get them to collide with each other. And so there's a history of many different accelerators built over the years, both at CERN in Geneva and also places like Fermilab here in the United States outside Chicago and the Stanford Linear Accelerator in California, the Brookhaven Accelerator in Long Island, but now the Large Hadron Collider is way above everything else in terms of energy and technology and so forth. And so we're just drawing on decades and lifetimes of experience in building these incredibly precise machines.
Sean, we were talking about the more than 100 countries that collaborated on CERN, and you were telling us how this all came about. Let's go through that again.
Yeah, it was, you know, the attempt to get European physics rolling after World War II. So they founded this laboratory, and they've done an amazing job at cooperating, the European countries, over the years. And, you know, the United States has not been a very good international partner. It tends to start things and then stop them and, you know, changes its mind and so forth. But and it went through some tough times. The Large Hadron Collider got started officially 1993. And that's about the time that Europe was struggling with reunification, right? You know, Germany was coming back together, the Berlin Wall falling and so forth. And it was not a time when the countries of Europe were very interested in spending money on particle physics, let's put it that way. But the management of CERN managed to convince everybody that it was worth doing, and it's been an amazing story since then.
How should I feel? Because I don't know much about the universe. I'm still trying to figure out who we are, how we started,
okay, yes,
and what it all means. I mean, should I feel like a fool, or are we all in the same boat here?
You should feel like an eager customer for buying my book, George. Come on, that's the obvious
that's
thing to
right.
make you feel a whole bit much better educated. But no, you know, I think that there's two things that are going on. One is that every one of us is a lot smaller than the universe, and you know, we should not feel humbled by the fact that we haven't figured it all out yet, whether we're a particle physicist or a Buddhist monk or anybody out there listening. It's just a very complicated universe we're in, and what's amazing is that we have figured out as much of it as we have. So we're all very tiny and ignorant compared to the whole universe. On the other hand, we're all part of the universe. We're all made of the same particles that are described by the standard model of particle physics, and it is understandable. It's alien in some way, which is not surprising because the world of particles is a very different regime than our everyday lives. You know, we are several feet tall, you know, we move around in a world in a certain set of speeds and so forth, and now we're talking about particles moving close to the speed of light that are incredibly tiny, that are governed by the rules of relativity and quantum mechanics, and it's a weird world, the world of particles. So it's not surprising that it seems strange to us, but it's absolutely understandable by anyone who makes the effort. And I don't mean like learning all the equations and all that. I just mean, you know, following the literature, the blogs, reading a couple books, watching a couple of TV shows, watch Morgan Freeman through the wormhole and so forth. And I think it's a very participatory thing. We're discovering new things about nature, and everyone has the right to follow along for the ride and see how it's going.
In the scheme of things, is it a wonderment that it's here, that the universe exists, or is this something that you think was just going to happen?
Well, that's a good question to which I don't know the answer. One of the great things about doing physics at this level is that we know a lot, but we also know exactly where the boundary is between what we know and what we don't know. And so that's on the don't know side, questions about why is there something rather than nothing. We don't even know whether that's a good question, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Is there an explanation for why the universe was here, or does it just happen, or is it just, did we just get lucky? Is it just an accident? I don't think we're allowed to demand either way. I don't think that, you know, when people say, well, obviously the universe just happened, you know, there's no deeper reasoning than that, or when other people say, obviously, there must be an explanation for the universe, and then, you know, we need to find it. We don't know either one of those things. I think we need to be open-minded about it, wait for our theoretical understanding to catch up to what we know. And until then, we should keep an open mind.
Well, there's no doubt about that. What about dark matter? What the heck is that?
Dark matter is a great topic because it is absolutely the next target after we found the Higgs boson. There's no question in my mind that dark matter exists. It's something that is not described by the standard model of particle physics. So you and me and the Earth and the Sun and the stars, these are all described by the standard model, quarks, leptons, the forces that we know. But we know enough about those particles to know that none of them are the dark matter. And we know the dark matter is there. We've detected its gravitational field. We can see its effect on light traveling through the universe and on stars orbiting galaxies over and over again. We can see very clearly and without a shadow of a doubt that dark matter is exerting a force, but we don't know what it is. We have plenty of theories. It's not hard to come up with an idea. People like me are fully employed, you know, writing down equations that describe new ideas about what the dark matter could be. And many of them predict that we should be able to find it pretty soon. We have a very robust experimental program that is looking for the dark matter. So it won't be completely dark anymore if our ideas are correct.
Universe, they say, almost 14 billion years old. How did they get these numbers, Sean?
Well, that's a happy achievement that we didn't have when I was a graduate student. You know, 20 years ago, we really didn't know. We had, you know, 10 billion, 15 billion, anywhere in there was okay. The idea is simply that the universe is expanding. It's getting bigger. We can look at distant galaxies, and they're moving away from us. So if you play the clock backwards, everything was closer together in the past. And when things are closer together, they're pulling on each other even faster. So the universe was expanding faster and faster as you go further and further into the past. So what you need is some theory, some model of the universe that lets you extrapolate from today backward And we have that now. We didn't have it when I was growing up, but you know, now that we know about dark matter and also something called dark energy, we have the basic ingredients to play the movie backwards and say, okay, how old does the universe have to be in this model to fit all the data we have? How fast is expanding, what the structure in the universe looks like, what the leftover radiation from the Big Bang looks like. And the answer is it needs to be 13.7 billion years old. If it were a little bit older or a little bit younger, it wouldn't fit the data that we have.
Okay, before that 13.7 billion years old, what was there? What happened?
I don't know. I have a theory. I have my own theory. I think that our universe came out of a bigger universe. I think that the universe...
You may be right.
Yeah, I mean, again, we should be open-minded. One possibility is the universe just started 13.7 billion years ago. There was no such thing as before that moment. Another possibility is that it was a phase. The Big Bang was sort of a moment in time, but there was another moment before that and more moments after that. I mean, to fit everything together, and the universe could be infinitely old. And I actually think that that story hangs together quite well and is more promising, but I'm very ready to admit that I don't have the final answer yet.
Could we have been popped through a wormhole?
Something like that. I think that's, you know, the kind of idea that is on the table, that, you know, there was a space that was just empty space that was existing for a long time, not doing very much of anything, quietly sitting there. But quantum mechanics says that there are fluctuations. There's unpredictable random events that happen. And so maybe one unpredictable random event could be a wormhole opening up and popping out a new universe, and there we are. That is something that we are absolutely taking seriously.
Sean, I know you're a scientist, but are you at a point where you would say you've got to add in an ingredient that we're just not aware of, whether it's consciousness, divine, you know, intelligence, something is out there that has helped contribute to all this? Can you say that as a scientist?
Yeah, you know, personally, I don't think that's true, actually. I think that we've been so successful at understanding as much as we have about the universe just based on the laws of nature as we are discovering them without external influences of any sort. That my bet is that's going to be the way we continue to go. The amazing thing about the universe is that it is able to come up with all of the wonderful complexity of the world that we see around us. You know, just the idea of a radio station, okay? It was not obvious if you look at what the universe was like 13.7 billion years ago. But it's the many, many, many tiny incremental steps of evolution just following the laws of nature that have led us here to this incredible complexity that we see around us. So my personal bet is that that program is going to continue to be more and more successful, and we'll have a purely natural explanation of the world we see.
But what about the why? I mean, here we are, we're doing this radio interview, we're talking about your wonderful work, The Particle at the End of the Universe. What are we all here for?
Well, it's a good question, and again, I think we should be open-minded. We may or may not be here for anything. My personal guess along these lines is that things like purpose and meaning, the reasons why, are things that we human beings come up with, not things that are given to us by the universe or from outside the universe. That it's our duty to assign and attribute meaningfulness and mattering to the events that occur around us. And I'm very comfortable with that. I think that's, you know, it's a exciting, liberating, although occasionally scary way to think about the universe, but it seems to be what matches what we actually see.
Do other scientists feel about the same way?
You know, it's not like an official stance or anything like that. I think that scientists tend to think along those lines when they do. There's plenty who don't. I have a good friend who is a theoretical cosmologist and also an evangelical Christian. And, you know, he throws in jokes occasionally that, well, this equation must be right because I think God would have wanted it that way. And he's not serious. He's doing science exactly the same way that the rest of us are. He's trying to come up with the best equations that describe the data, but he truly in his heart believes that there is a purpose that comes from outside the universe. So, you can do good science no matter what those beliefs are, but I think that more than the general audience, scientists tend to believe that ultimately we'll understand it all in terms of just the basic laws, the equations that govern how matter and energy behave.
When you were on, we were talking about From Here to Eternity some time ago. How does that differ from this writing, The Particle at the End of the Universe?
It's a little bit different, actually. From Eternity to Here was a lot about my own research, or at least the underlying ideas that drive my research in trying to understand the origin of the universe and the nature of time, how the past is different from the future. For The Particle at the End of the Universe, when I'm talking about the Higgs boson, it's related to what I do for a living, but it's not exactly the same. So in some sense, I was acting like an anthropologist, going in and figuring out how this tribe behaves and what it is they're doing. And I was impressed with experimental particle physics before I ever started, and I came away much more impressed than I even came into it with, because it's just such an incredible challenge to do what these people do. And as a result, I tried to write a book not only explains the science, that's always the major goal, but also to convey some of the passion and excitement that the physicists themselves have. Why is it that they care about the Higgs boson of all things, right? It seems like a bizarre thing to care about. It's not going to lead to a cure for cancer or a better smartphone or anything like that. It's just figuring stuff out. And people have devoted their lives. And it's kind of it's an amazing little part of humanity that we have these people who think that there's nothing more important than finding a new particle of nature.
If there was one question that you would love to get the answer for, what would that be?
Well, I'm sure I will give you an answer, but first let me dodge a little bit. I'm sure that if I knew what physics was like 100 years from now, in the future, I would think that whatever question I'm going to want the answer to now would seem naive. Right?
Right, I would think so.
What we consider to be a good question changes as we know more and more things. But right now, the huge question in physics is how to reconcile gravity, Einstein's theory of general relativity, which describes the curvature of space and time, and that is what creates gravity, with quantum mechanics, the theory that we have of the subatomic world and the Higgs boson, for example. These two tremendously successful theories, general relativity and quantum mechanics, and without them, we can't explain the world. With them, we can, but they're mutually inconsistent with each other. So something's going to have to give, and a lot of brain power is being spent trying to reconcile that.
Would you say that everything that's out there in the universe just gelled perfectly? Even our solar system, where, we need the moon to survive. We need Jupiter where it is to block us, it just all seems to work. How come?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And one of the, I think that rather than, I just talked about quantum gravity, but an equally good question could have been, how did life begin? What was the first?
Gosh, that was my next. That was my next one.
I don't have the answer to that one either. But I'm actually, since I wrote From Eternity to Here about entropy and the arrow of time, I've become more interested in the origin of life, because life is, in some sense, it seems odd from the point of view that entropy is increasing and the universe is just running down and becoming more tired and disorderly, right? But it turns out that when you look at it closely, you expect complicated structures to form as entropy increases. The temporary phenomenon, they will eventually go away, but complexity is a natural outgrowth of the increase of entropy in the universe. So in some sense, it's not surprising that life arose at all. It just happens all the time that some form of complex information processing structures would appear all by themselves. What we don't know is enough about the chemistry of the early Earth to say, does this happen 1% of the time, 1/1,000,000th of a percent of the time, or almost never, or almost always? Right now, the way that we here on Earth, you're right, we need Jupiter and the moon and something like that. But if it weren't for Jupiter and the moon, maybe there'd be a completely different kind of life that would be very happy in that condition. That's what we don't know.
No, that's what we don't know at all. Interesting. Okay, well, the name of the book, The Particle at the End of the Universe. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more with you, Sean, about this, about the complexity in the universe as well. Plus, we'll take some phone calls. This is your opportunity to talk to a real theoretical physicist. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.